interview with Judge Patricia Stanford Love on Tuesday, November 7, 1995, in her Chapel Hill home. This is an interview for the Southern Oral History Program's North Carolina Politics series. My name is Joe Meunier, and this is cassette number 11.7.95-PL. Judge, I thought to begin, if you could give a brief overview of your biographical history.
Well, I was born in Dunn, North Carolina, actually in Irwin, I always have to say Harnett County, and left North Carolina shortly after I was born. My family moved to Florida, first to northern Florida, and then on down, finally to Miami and Coral Gables. I had one sister who is now deceased. I went to what was then Ponce de Leon Senior High School, now Junior High School. Now they call it Coral Gables Senior High. And then I went to Sweetbriar College in Virginia for 2 years, waiting to get into the university. That time women couldn't get in until they were juniors. Transferred here and graduated in journalism and just let it ring. Except it's going to bother this. Isn't it? graduated in journalism and got married my senior year. My husband insisted I get a teacher's certificate. I never thought I would teach, but I did. After we were married, we graduated in 1950. And we both applied for and were accepted to UNC School of Law. I found out shortly thereafter that I was pregnant, so I withdrew from law school. He stayed on a semester, and then his father's health failed, and it was really necessary for him to go back to the farm. So I then, in fairly rapid succession, had four boys. Which equals maybe 12 children, I'm not sure about. And then when my youngest was 3 years old, I received a fellowship from the Rockefellers through the AAUW for mature women. So you've got an idea of what mature women is. I don't know what that makes me now, because that was in 63 when I went back and got a master's in American history. I had expected to go to law school then, but they wouldn't let me go part-time, so I got a master's instead. Got my JD shortly before my 50th birthday, and that was many years later. Graduated in 1978.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about some of your earliest involvements in political groups, women's groups at the local level.
Well, in high school, when I was growing up, there weren't any women who were presidents of anything. We were secretaries or treasurers, and I was extremely interested in politics from the beginning. I can remember in the sixth grade organizing a club and the principal forcing me to do away with that club because I wouldn't let everybody in. So, and I helped in high school. I was always somebody's campaign manager, and when I got married, I was extremely interested in politics, and my husband was too, because his father was one of the very best friends. Carr Scott, who was governor, running for governor when we met, was one of his best friends. He'd been his college roommate and lived farm to farm out in the country. So he was extremely interested in the in politics then, and I got him interested in politics, and so he became the president of the Young Democrats in Orange County. And then went on from there to be to run for county commissioner and serve as the chairman, and then on to the legislature. But I, in the meantime, I joined the Junior Service League and had a great time. Was lots of fun, a non-political kind of situation, and I really continued to sort of to be his support. And then when I decided to go back to start teaching, I then joined the teachers' organizations and was president of the local chapters of what was in the NCAE in the Classroom Teachers Association. And I was president of both those organizations locally.
Educators,
mm-hmm, which included the principals, and the classroom teachers did not. Mm-hmm. The NCAE asked me to set up a citizenship committee which I did. It was a state committee. It was an ad hoc committee. And I toured North Carolina talking to teachers in their meetings, their faculty meetings, about voting. I asked them how many were registered to vote. The teacher salary was extraordinarily low. And my husband was in the legislature, and I was saying to him, why don't you do something about teacher salaries? And he would say, well, there's no groundswell for it. You have to, the legislature is strictly controlled by the Appropriations Committee, actually a subcommittee of it. And until you get some clout, nothing. And I was just shocked to find that all over the state, very, very few teachers were even registered to vote. So I did a follow-up study after that, because I wrote them all letters and said, okay, now I've been to see you. You promised to register, have you? And I had a contact in most of the classrooms. I didn't see every school, but I saw a lot of schools. And they would write me back and tell me how many had registered. And then I did a third mailing in which I said, okay, November has come and gone. Did you vote? So we were able then to say, we've got this many people registered to vote. And so that's where the North Carolina Association of Educators PAC really started from, was that kind of situation where we could say, and we asked them in the beginning to contribute $5, which for teachers was a lot of money. And so we got some PAC money, not much, but it began a very long, and now they're a very powerful lobbying group and have a lot of clout in Raleigh. But that's and I actually, while Donald was still in the House, I was one of those who marched around the legislative building demanding better salaries for teachers and smaller classrooms and some sick leave. You know, when I first started teaching, we didn't have any sick leave at all. We had two personal, well, we started with one personal day a year, and then we had two. But in order to take a personal day of leave, you had to get permission, and then when you took the leave, you had to pay for the substitute. And the sad thing was we paid $7.50 for somebody to come and sit 8 hours, in 6 hours, I guess, in the in a classroom, and you know what substitute teachers go through. Oh, it's terrible. So those were some of the things that that we wanted. And so Tom White was then chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And I remember very well the day, I think it was the day after we had marched, I went to a social gathering for the legislature as a wife, and out at the Carolina Country Club. And there was Tom White, and I went over and spoke to him, and he asked me if he hadn't seen me marching around the legislature, and I said, yep, but that was with my other hat as a teacher. I joined that. I was very active in the Democratic Women. I was president of that organization, too, in Orange County. Mm-hmm.
About when exactly?
Oh, that must have been probably in the late 50s. You know, they always want to get the wives involved, and we were organizing. You know, I was in all kind of campaigns for him, and worked in a couple other campaigns, locally and otherwise. And so it was, but always as the worker bee, you know. Then Donald had cancer. He was 42, and. His birthday was on the 7th of May, and he died on the 5th and was buried on his birthday. The election had been the Democratic primary had been the Saturday before, and in fact, they had been on the radio saying he was dead. He wasn't dead, but his father died. His father died on a Friday, and he died the following Tuesday. It was a real tragic thing, particularly for my children, to lose her father and their grandfather, because my father was already dead, and so it was a real struggle. Carl Smith took his seat in the House and went on to, as naturally in Orange County, in Orange and Chatham County, won that seat with Ike Andrews as his seatmate, who was from Chatham County then. And Ike had been over there several terms. after Donald died, and the and Carl had been elected. It's a 2-year term, so he filed for a second term, and he called me up the day or two before the last filing date, and said to me, "I'm going to switch my filing to the Senate, and nobody's going to know it until the last minute, and so why don't you file for Donald's seat?"
So this is anticipating the November
71. Donald died in 70, so that was you're elected in the even years and you serve right. in the odd years. Yeah, so it was the 72 election.
Okay.
So the 72 election, I was a guidance counselor then at the high school. And he called me, as I recall, it was that I had a weekend in between to make up my mind. Well, I was really shocked. I had, of course, been appointed by Governor Scott to serve Donald's term out, which was a couple months. The legislature wasn't in session. There was nothing for me to do. It was strictly honorary. In fact, I refused it once, and my children really wanted me to take it, so
refused
I did.
On what grounds?
That I refused it? Yeah. Well, because Carl was going to be the new House member, and I had so when they first came to me and said, we would love to ask the governor to appoint you, they said that'd be a really nice thing. And I thought, yeah, well, that's nice. That's sort of an honor of him and my children. And I said, but what does Carl say? Because I didn't really want to interfere with Carl. Carl called me and said he had no problem with that. That would be fine. He thought that was a nice thing to do and hoped I would accept it. And then some of his people got to him, and there was just big brouhaha about whether or not I should be appointed or Carl should. We didn't really have to appoint anybody. I mean, there wasn't anything to do. So then I said, no, I'm not going to do it, because why should I go through all this? And but I had some friends who had made some commitments and said, well, you said you would do it. And so I said, okay, if you can get the governor. And then,
Let me ask you if I could, we move forward from that point. Let me ask a few questions about some events in the 60s and what sort of impression they made upon you and so forth. First, I wanted to ask, for example, in your activities on behalf of the teachers and your efforts mm-hmm. in Raleigh to lobby for increased educational funding and salaries, did those sorts of political roles cause you any, were there personal or other tensions associated with that type of political activity on your part, either on account of the fact that your husband was in the General Assembly or maybe in your world of social contacts here in Chapel Hill and so forth?
Well, one of the things that it did do that really I hadn't even considered at the time, because I was so outspoken about it, I'd been president of these two associations, not at the same time, but almost, you know, one right after the other. I was raising my voice very loudly, and I was asking all these teachers, why couldn't we, you know, speak with more people speaking? And they said, your husband has a job. Your husband, you don't need to work. And so if you get fired, the world, and they're not going to fire you because your husband's in the legislature anyway. So it became really obvious to me that in order to speak out, I was the one to do it because I did have some safeguards. So in fact, in Chapel Hill, they were actively talking about a teachers union. Now, I think they have one now, but at that time, that was considered really wild. And, you know, this is not a union state by a long shot. So they were very upset with Chapel Hill even talking about it. And we used to go to teachers' conventions and talk about to our people. You know, we'd say, well, why do we have this organization that won't go on strike, that won't do anything? Let's get us a union. So, and then my husband would say to me, wonder if you could tone that down a little bit. But so we were kind of a hotbed, and Chapel Hill, you know, I guess always is a hotbed of something. And we, and because of my circumstances, I got a lot of flack when I'd go to Raleigh. You know, they'd say, "Oh, that's all you care about, are the teachers. All you care about." And I said, "No, what I care about is the children. But they're not going to get good teachers if we don't do better than what we're doing."
Mm-hmm. the women's movement of the 60s have a sort of broad impact on you?
Not really, and not until much, not until after the 60s. The civil rights, the integration was a big thing. My husband was chairman of the county commissioners when they decided to integrate the Chapel Hill schools. And there was a good deal of strife and conversation and emotion. And I remember vividly one night, he said, we have to go to Hillsborough. And we got his sisters to stay with the children. We went to Hillsborough and covered in the courthouse. They had water fountains for white and colored and bathrooms for white and colored. And we covered those signs and put male and female over them. Our children, our friends, many of my friends' children transferred to private schools.
Your own children transferred to private
schools? Not my own, no. My husband was adamant that no matter what, he thought the public school system was going to be the savior of the state, and that if the private schools, if there was such a white flight, then the state was doomed. And, you know, his middle name was McKeever, and he was kin to Charles D. McKeever. And his family was raised, there's just educators everywhere in his family, and he believed in public education. So those children were going to stay. But those are the kinds of things, I think, that began to open our eyes as we saw what I guess Southerners had never really seen, at least not those of us who were in cocoons. And,
did such things as the integration of the schools and the passage of the Civil Rights Act, passage of the Voting Rights Act, the speaker ban law, all this tumult of the 60s, do you think it shifted your fundamental personal politics?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think that's that was one of the really amazing things, because my family and his family both were watching us change from really people who had very little interest, very little a clue to what was going on, until suddenly here was this giant upheaval. And, you know, every day you were making a new decision about something and really caring about what was happening to people you knew. And I remember Mr. McDougall, for whom the Chapel Hill's new middle school is named, he and his wife went to, came to a gathering, which I think was a political gathering, down on Rosemary Street in what used to be called the Shack down there. And then the but anyway, they had a political gathering down there, and the McDougals came in, and at that moment they were the only black faces in that whole crowd. And Donald stepped up to speak to him because he knew him. He had been president of the PTAs, and he spoke to him and to her and asked them to come and sit with us. And it was there was just this dead silence as they moved over to speak. And he began to introduce them to various people around. And Mr. McDougall told me many, many years later what a wonderful thing that was, to feel that there was one person in that room who would be willing to stick their hand out. So those things were just opening our eyes, opening our world to what was really going around. Mm-hmm. My children, two of my children went to what was the Lincoln School. After they integrated, they decided to close that one down. But at one point, while they were making all kind of plans, they sent everybody in the sixth grade out there. And I remember Donald was asked to be the president of PTA out there. He went out mainly because they thought he might have some clout, and he was shocked to see the condition of a Lincoln school. But you know, he'd never been in it before.
So
he
this
just
would have been about what year?
No, that was when he was on the board of commissioners, so it probably was around 1960.
So he finds this previously all black school.
All black school, just terrible shape. The blinds, I remember the blinds were all falling down and halfway fixed. I remember we went into the library, and my children had been at Glenwood. Glenwood then was the brand new elementary school, and Glenwood was surrounded by a lot of Chapel Hillians who were full of money and books and adamant about education, and the library at Glenwood was just amazing. When we walked into that Lincoln Library, it was so pathetic. It was just awful.
And these were things I imagine you had literally not seen.
We had never, ever seen them. In fact, we were, we just felt so naive and dumb that we hadn't, but you know, we didn't go to school with blacks. We didn't go to the university with blacks. We didn't socialize with them. We didn't know them. And it was just absolutely astonishing to us that what they were saying was absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your decision to enter the legislature. Obviously, Carl Stewart gives you this chance to...
Carl Smith.
Carl Smith, I beg your pardon. Gives you the chance to file. Yeah. So you'd be in well positioned. But why was that an attractive choice for you to make to enter the legislature?
Well, what I did after he talked to me, my stomach just flipped, you know. And I was really... scared to do this. But I call teachers, I call my colleagues all over the school system and in various places in Hillsborough, in Chatham County, all over, and said, what do you think? Will you work for me? Would you help me? What could I do? And I said, well, you could stuff envelopes. They said, stuff them with what? I said, I don't know, but people are always stuffing them. So I said, well, I've got Donald's list, and I've worked these counties, and I know a lot, and I know a lot of people. I'd also worked for the American Heart Association for a while, and I had to go out in the county and find people who would collect for the Heart Association, so I had a lot of context from that. Well, the teachers were just, they were magnificent. They were so excited because what it meant was there was going to be a teacher in Raleigh. And so they were, and they knew how hard and long I had been working for that. And they said, sure, and they did. It was amazing. And I called Dot Kanzler and asked her if she'd be my campaign manager, and she said she'd never run a campaign before, but she said, sure. I needed a contact at the university, and she was going to be my contact there. Her husband was in the student affairs office. And I guess the reason that I decided to run was because, and the interesting financial part of it was that I sat down and figured it out, that I would make more money as a part-time legislator than I would as a full-time guidance counselor. And incidentally, another thing that made that happen was the school system had an assistant superintendent for curriculum. He had, you know, they used to come here, get their PhDs, and then leave. They'd have a year or so, 5 years of experience, and then they would go on to be a superintendent somewhere. So when he left to be a superintendent, they called me up and said, would you like to be an assistant superintendent and move out of the guidance office at the high school and come downtown? And I said, well, what does it pay? I went down there and talked to them about it. And what they were paying me 10 months because I was a guidance counselor. All the other teachers got nine and a quarter after a while. But, so I got 10 months pay. And they said, well, we'll pay you 12 months, but you make the same pay, but you get 2 extra months. And the guy who had left was making just about triple what I was making, because I had a master's degree, I had 10 years experience, and I was making somewhere a little less than $1,000 a month. And I said, why don't you pay me what you paid him? I'll get my PhD and I'll move on too, they said. Oh, no, well, we can't do that, no. Mm-mm. And they never said, after all, you're just a female teacher. But I got the message and I said, never. So I think that was my first introduction. That and finding out about bank tellers. I had a good friend who was a bank teller right after I was a widow. One of my sons, who shall be nameless, had a savings account down at NCNB. And he had his savings book with him. But he went down there and withdrew some money. And when they sent him a statement, it did not reflect that withdrawal. So he went down and withdrew it a second time. Well, my friend at the bank called me to say that he had done this and obviously was not entitled to the money. So, but as I was talking to her about that problem, she started telling me what bank tellers make and how bad it was. The rich people still in banks do not stand behind the counters. And it was absolutely amazing because at that time, that bank and every other bank, I'm sure, were paying male tellers and female tellers differently. And if female tellers were married, which is what they used to say to us in the legislature, well, female teachers, they all got a husband, and he's the one that's making the money, so they don't need any more money. Used to say that to me so many times. Found out the tellers were going through the same kind of thing.
What kind of, on arrival in Raleigh in January of 73, I guess, can you describe, and I'd like you to do it in some detail, the nature of the political culture that prevailed there?
Well, there were very few of us women. And every one of us, I think, at that time had gotten there as an appointee of the governor, usually to fill our husband's seats. So I had, too, in a sort of a way, been there. They were very chivalrous. They opened a lot of doors for you. And they were very nice to you. And if you were nice to them, then they would do what they could to help you get your office straight or to get you. We had a secretarial pool then, and my friend Ed Holmes, who served with me in the legislature, was from Chatham County. And we had to get a secretary from the pool, and our offices were next door to each other. And in fact, there was a... they were so close, you could just... They were so small, too. So he said, well, when somebody calls, we'll take turns. You answer, and I'll answer. And in fact, I think we had the same phone. I can't remember whether they were hooked together some way. So when he would answer the phone, he would say, this is Representative Hunt's administrative assistant. And when I answered, he wanted me to say this was Representative Holmes' secretary, and I said, never. We're both AAs or neither. So, and he would laugh. He was always a very good friend of mine and helped me a lot. But so they didn't really, I guess, take us seriously. And
how many women were there?
I think there were nine of us in the Senate and the House. And we were an unusual crew, too. We didn't all feel the same way about everything. I mean, we were united really rarely. Education was one thing we were united on. But abortion rights or liquor by the drink or any of the other things that would come up, we knew we'd be split many ways. And so we had to figure. So we started a women's caucus. We had we'd meet for lunch and talk about something we wanted to do, and it made everybody extremely nervous. So
they
didn't know what we were doing or why we were doing it, and what was the why couldn't we all have lunch together? And we would say, well, that's just fine, but we never got invited, you know. And we knew what was going on. We knew that there were people who were meeting in groups. And but there were really very few things that we could all unite on because we came from different parts of the state because we just were not a one unified kind of group. I remember one time Chief Justice then, Susie Sharp, called and asked me if I would gather the women's caucus together. She wanted to come talk to us. So we got a kind of a fancy lunch fixed that day in one of those dreary rooms. And she came over, and what she wanted to talk to us about was the United States Supreme Court had just determined that you could not execute someone unless they had killed someone or had been actively involved in felony murder. So at that time, North Carolina had laws that said arson, first-degree burglary, rape, and murder were all capital crimes. So they were all going by the by. And so the decision of the legislature was then murder could be the only capital crime. And she wanted us to be sure that we did something about rape that would make it a horrendous crime. And we were saying to her, you know, we're not getting any convictions for rape. Because it was a capital crime, nobody, the juries would say, no, we're not going to execute somebody for raping somebody. So they would find them not guilty. And we said, the DAs have been to see us, and they told us that what we ought to do is to get something reasonable so that they could get some convictions. Well, she didn't like that a bit, and she said we would be traitors to womanhood if we didn't make it. Yeah, absolutely. She was just adamant on the subject. And so was my mother. My mother just thought that rape was a lot more horrible than murder. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that as Chief Justice back in those days, that I mean, obviously there weren't many women sitting in that spot.
She was. Yes, and that was amazing to us too. You know, yeah. But her history, of course, comes through her father too. So.
Are there any persons, male members of the legislature, who stand out sharply in your mind for reasons related to things we've been talking about?
Well, I think the most outstanding legislator that I knew to begin with was Carl Stewart. He was a Duke graduate. He came out of the mill towns up there in Gastonia. He was went over there on scholarships. And I think he was top of his class in law school and undergraduate, too. He was just a brain. And when he was serving on the Appropriations Committee, when I went on the Appropriations Committee, he...
Which would have been 75
session? 70. No, I think I went there on 72.
Okay.
That I went as... he was not chairman that year, but he was on there. He was chairman of a subcommittee I was on, which I think might have been education.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking about the judiciary.
Yeah, this later. But Carl clearly was someone who knew what he was talking about, and he knew that budget inside and out. And people have always said Kenneth Royal knew it, and he did. But he didn't know it. He never knew it like Carl knew it. And Carl knew, I mean, he would know every single teeny weeny little deal, you know. And I was just amazed, and I learned so much. And I had been teaching North Carolina history, Dr. Leffler. I had been his graduate assistant. At least I was grading papers for him, and I had been teaching North Carolina history at his request. He's the one that called me up and said they need a teacher over at Guy B. Phillips. Would you just go over there and teach 6 weeks till they can find a permanent teacher and teach North Carolina history? And then he and I helped him, but he put my name on the book. Of North Carolina history. And I would say to him, you know, I've learned more from Carl Stewart on the Appropriations Committee than I ever learned anywhere else, because that's where the action is. And then the person who sat behind me was Al Adams from Raleigh. And Al Adams is another really, really bright person. And he has a quick mind and is a marvelous lawyer. He got me interested in serving on a committee called Banks and Thrift Institutions, and he said, I want you and Ruth Cook from Raleigh, I want you and Ruth to serve on this committee, and he said, I'm going to try to arrange it, and so he did, and we were put on Banks and Thrift Institutions. That was probably in 73 or 74. And what we discovered was that on Banks and Thrift Institutions, everybody but us three were members of a board of directors of a bank or thrift institution. And so what was amazing was that as soon as we were put on there, we got overtures from banks and thrift institutions to join their board of directors. Well, Al, he had principle. He knew what he was doing, and he could really rouse that legislature. Herbert Hyde was another one who was a marvelous speaker, a wonderful constitutional lawyer, and could tell the best stories, and he had a wonderful voice, and he was very, very bright, too, could write, and I just loved it when he would he stood up after I had introduced this local bill, which was unconstitutional, and he got up and made this flowery speech about this little local bill that his friend had introduced, and he said, I just want you to know, all of you to know, that it's unconstitutional. However, until a judge tells you it's unconstitutional, you don't have to worry about it. But he was a wonderful person to go to for advice. He would tell you the truth, and he would tell you things like that. It is blatantly unconstitutional, and this is the reason why. However, until somebody gets to it, so that had to do with some Chapel Hill deals. You know how they always came up with these wild things. I think that was the one that set up their appearance commission. You know. There were other members of the legislature that I had a tremendous respect for. Jack Stevens from Asheville was a very good legislator and also a very good lawyer. There were a lot of lawyers in the legislature then. There are not now. And it has created, I think, a different kind of legislature. Because every time I would introduce a bill, they would say, well, let's go let the lawyers look at it. We'll send it over to the J Committee. So I decided, okay, well, then I'm going to have to go to law school. So I applied again. And so for the third time, I had been accepted. And I went, this time I went while I was in the legislature.
Starting 1975. Mm-hmm. Let me ask about some of the legislation okay. you introduced. And actually, before I do that, I wanted to ask one further question. Were there episodes, and it may come out as we talk about some of this legislation, were there episodes and other anecdotes you recall that have a specifically gendered character, women's treatment, women's experiences over in Raleigh, beyond the things we've talked about to date?
Well, one of the, to me, one of the most poignant memories was in an ERA debate when they were arguing about their daughters. They didn't want their daughters slaughtered on the fields of battle, and they didn't want their daughters going to war, and they didn't want their daughters having to live in barracks. And they went on and on, several of them. And I'm trying to think of the legislator, who was such a famous, came from such a famous family. I think he lives in Edenton, but I can't think of his name right now. But he, and he was a good friend of mine, but he kept on and on about how he had two little girls, and it just gave him nightmares to think about it. And so I stood up and said, well, do you think that your two little daughters are better than my four little sons? And it just, and the whole house sort of just sat there sort of shocked for a few minutes, and then they clapped, you know, and we went on. The ERA debate sometimes would get very gender-oriented, which obviously it should have. But the kinds of things that would really hurt would be the things that they would say, our husbands will take care of us. We can discuss with them. We don't need anything in the Constitution to say we're equal. We know we're equal. Our husbands tell us we're equal. And then they would get up and start talking about, you all are more than equal. You know, you live longer, so you inherit all the money. Those kinds of statements would just make you mad. And what they were really saying to us over and over again was, we don't want it in the Constitution in case we want to change it. And I guess that that was one of the biggies. The other thing was the Appropriations Committee, and I used to think it was horrible, but I really understand now that there's no way you can really appropriate the money of the state and make it come out even. I mean, for the federal government, you can do your little thing, you know, and print some more money. But in the state, it has to come out even under the Constitution, and because I never have known a legislature who was willing to do otherwise, legislator. So there have to be a small number of people who make this happen, especially when the governor does not have a veto. So in that small committee, which was a joint committee of the House and Senate Appropriations Committee, the decisions that would be made there, and if you went and talked to some of those people and said, now this is really important to me that we do this, I remember we wanted to appropriate money then for the parks in the state parks in North Carolina, and we were talking about Killdevil Hills and some of the what things that were happening. And I remember one legislator patting me on the head and saying, "We'll take care of this. Don't you worry your little head about it." That kind of attitude was very demeaning and very depressing, but they weren't all like that. But I think down deep in their hearts, most of them, probably all of them, had a feeling, I guess the same feeling we had about blacks that in the beginning. We just didn't believe that the things were happening, and I don't think they believed it either about women. They really didn't think that we could handle it. And
how did it come to pass that you became the chief sponsor, floor leader, and conference chair, the chief sponsor and floor leader on five occasions for ERA? What motivated you to pick up that cause?
Well, and that's very strange because, as I said, the women's movement did not affect me very much. I mean, it didn't until I got over there. And, in fact, the first session that we dealt with the ERA, it passed the House, was on its way to the Senate, and lost. Bill Staton voted against it, who had promised us he would vote for it. So it lost just barely. Well, I thought then, well, this will pass next time. This is not a big deal. And it wasn't a big deal. Nobody made a big deal out of it. Staton was very upset about the consequences as far as the draft was concerned, and he had said at the very last minute, "I just can't bring myself to vote for it." But I thought there were several others that we could probably change their minds, so I wasn't worried about it. And then we got this large group of very active now women's political caucus. These types came over there. Some of them are very good friends from Chapel Hill. And they started making a big deal out of it. And when they started making a big deal out of it, some of the male members who were going to vote for it, some of the people that had voted for it before, became very upset about it because they said, now it's going to be an issue. I originally tried to defuse them and to try to keep them. I kept begging them not to come over there making demonstrations or remarks that were inflammatory. But I could not. You know, you just can't stop the fire. And I understood the fire in their belly, but I also had become a pretty good politician, at least to the extent to know that once you make an issue of something, then people got to stand on one side or the other. So that's when it started. The other thing is, in those days, I was a pretty good speech maker. I could really hold an audience. I don't know exactly where I learned it, but I learned to read an audience very early on, and maybe because I was a teacher. You know, you had that audience, either you lost them pretty fast or they were a tough audience. I could really make speeches to committees or to the House itself that would really generate some activity. And I changed some votes. We kept very close tallies on them. And so I was sort of shoved into the middle of it. People would say, what do you think? Then one day, after it had lost, I guess, twice, the Philadelphia chapter of the Equal Rights, maybe it's Women for Equal Rights or whatever, as part of a national organization, called me up and said, "We're going to hold a fundraiser, and we'd like to raise money for North Carolina because this is going to be a critical state, critical vote. And we've heard that you can really make speeches and turn loose some of this solid Pennsylvania money." So I said, "Well, I'd be glad to try." Well, they put me on a plane, and I went to Philadelphia, and we had a breakfast. I went to a brunch, I went to a lunch, I went to a cocktail hour, I went to a dinner, and I went to a supper. And at each one of these, at various places, they were hauling me all around the city, you know. I made a speech, and they contributed money. So when you start collecting money, I've forgotten now how much it was. Seemed to me $25,000. That was a lot of money. Then you become a leader in a hurry. The other thing is, I think they really wanted a woman to be leading it. So,
before asking a few more questions about the ERA and the legislature, did your identification as leader in this effort, did that have any ramifications in your network of social contact?
Yes, it sure did. It was amazing because I had gotten married again, and Thomas's friends were in Durham, mm-hmm. and you sort of followed your husband's friends, particularly if you were in Raleigh and your friends were in Chapel Hill, because there was just so much time, and we did have a lot of friends among the legislature too. So when I would go to his Durham friends, most of whom, Thomas was 12 years older than I, and his friends were his age, and those women did not understand, did not like, did not appreciate, and were always asking me questions about what was I afraid of? Wasn't I sure of myself and this kind of thing? And they were scared. They didn't want to go to war. They didn't want their granddaughters or granddaughters to go. So they gave me a lot of conversation. My own mother didn't like it either. She was really old school Southern woman, and she didn't like it. I'm not sure she really liked me being in the legislature, but anyway. So, yes, it did, and